This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. Off the Shelf gives a voice to commercial service and product companies selling in the federal market. Roger speaks to members and government officials about procurement policy trends, innovations, and debates. Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Now your host, Roger Waldron.
Today, my guests on Off the Shelf are Jason Workmaster and Jack Horan. They are partners at McKenna, Long & Aldridge and regular... guests on the show to bring us up to date on the latest in government contract law news, events, and trends. Jason, Jack, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Roger.
Thank you, Roger. Good to be here.
Yeah, well, I'm looking forward to it. This is always a fun show. Talk about what happened last year a little bit, where you see things headed, and you know, what does it all mean for government contractors? You know, the world we live in, we need people like you guys, right? You lawyers, right? Okay, to keep people out of trouble or straighten people out, depending on the situation, correct?
Absolutely.
That's right. Okay, so let's get right into it. You know, GAO, I guess in the beginning of January, came out with its annual bid protest report to Congress, you know, detailing the numbers and, you know, some various features of it. So, you know, you've had a chance to take a look at it, Jason. Yeah. Sure. What strikes you, or, you know, give us a lowdown on it.
Sure. Well, it's striking. There's a number of things that are striking in the statistics this year. First, I just note that there continues to be a lot of bid protests. There was a slight decrease, only about a 2% decline in 2013 versus 2012. So, but we're still seeing you know, over 2,400 protests filed in 2013, which is still a significant number of protests. What's interesting also, another thing that hasn't changed much between 2012 and 2013 is the percentage of protests where the protester is getting essentially what it wants when it files the protest. GAO calls that its effectiveness rate, and that rate stayed right around 43%. The year before it had been 42, so it was right around what it had been. So 43% of protests, when they're filed, the protester, either the agency voluntarily takes some form of corrective action, or the protest goes to a sustain at the end of, you know, gets a decision that results in a sustain from GAO. So that's stayed about the same. What's been a little different in 2013 is that we have seen an uptick in the number of protests that relate to task order procurements. So these are protests where you have an IDIQ contract in place, and then there is a task order award, and then there's a protest. That is increased now out of about 2,500 protests filed last year. Over 10% of them were task order level protests, which is an increase of almost, you know, a little over a percent from the year before, and up significantly from 2008.
Yes, and why do you think that is? Is it just people more sensitive to the ability to protest bigger order? Because isn't it over $10 million?
It's over $10 million, and of course, Congress had amended the statute a number of years ago to give GAO, prior to the amendment of the statute, GAO's jurisdiction to hear task order protests was fairly limited. Then Congress amended the statute, allowed protesters to protest orders over $10 million. And so I think we're seeing this as that we get further out from when that legislation was enacted. We see more and more protests at that level. And it also shows that the agencies are doing a lot of procurements under IDIQs at the task order level.
Now, do we know, Jason, and maybe it's a good question, if we don't know, I think it's something we ought to go back and look at, is like those task orders, that include protests against orders off the GSA schedule?
I doubt that it does. I would need to go back and look at the statistics, but I doubt that it does, because those have always been protestable.
Right. This is really that. Yes. You know, that delta where now you have the new authority, where Correct. Before you could only do scope issues. Now you can do evaluation issues and yes. selection issues and that sort of thing.
Correct.
Yeah, because it would be interesting, actually, and they may, I would suggest to them that they put another chart in there maybe, or just track how many schedule protests you get on an annual basis as mm-hmm. well, just to see. You know, yep. I think it would be an interesting to see, because to your point, it's something that has always been protestable under the schedules program, mm-hmm. right? Any kind of order, any size. So, mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about you mentioned the 45%, 40 mm-hmm. approximately success rate.
Yes.
You know, what were the issues that, you know, I know GAO sort of reports on this. What issues were more likely to succeed or not?
It's actually this last report was the first time that GAO.
Oh, really? Okay.
This was the first time GAO has reported on what issues result in sustains.
I know I've heard them talk about that.
They've talked about it. Absolutely. They've, okay. they've talked about it before.
And I don't want to look bad on my own show. Especially on the radio, right?
and it's not surprising. Actually, we at McKenna had done a survey of this ourselves and reached the same conclusion. And then GAO, you know, of course, comes along and confirms what at McKenna had already concluded. But the grounds most likely to result in a sustained protest are ones that involve errors the agency commits in the process itself. And so GAO identified four grounds, and they didn't rank them, so we don't know, you know, which one is first, second, third, and fourth. But the four grounds they identified as the most prevalent reasons for sustains are, first, failure to follow the solicitation criteria. So if a solicitation says you're going to do a best value trade-off, and technical is more important, technical and past performance are more important than price, and then lo and behold, you get the record, and the agency decided, well, price is more important than technical and past performance, that's going to be a sustain. That's a failure to follow the solicitation criteria. Second, inadequate documentation. You know, so again, my example of the best value, the solicitation says technical and past performance more important than price, and you get the record and it simply says we determine that offeror A represented the best value, period. Well,
right.
That is not going to be good enough. That's a failure to adequately document, and GAO will review that and say, nope, not good enough, agency, go do it again. Unequal treatment. That's a little bit more nuanced than the other two. You know, again, in a context of, say, a technical evaluation where one offeror, say you're proposing to sell the government desktop computers, and government beats up one offeror for proposing a particular Dell laptop, desktop, and then doesn't beat up the other offeror for proposing the exact same thing. That's unequal treatment. So they'll be looking, you know, they'll be on the lookout for, GAO will be on the lookout for that kind of issue. Have you been fair to the offerors and the technical and past performance evaluation? So that's number three. And then number four, unreasonable price cost evaluation. And this is to, you know, when there's a protester challenges the agency's evaluation of its own price, say they, you know, they say the agency has found that the protesters' price was unrealistic, it was too low, or the protester comes in and says, hey, that other guy's price is way higher than mine, you should have found that it was unreasonable. That's another area where GAO will review with a, you know, some bit more scrutiny what the agency has done, and that's the fourth area that GAO has identified that is most prevalent in its sustains.
Right. From your experience, which one of those grounds is the most, I guess, likely to succeed? You know, you're not graduating from high school here, but if you're a protester, I always struck me that, you know, the unequal treatment or discussion issues, because that's sort of like a what if kind of thing.
Yep.
Is that?
Yes, absolutely. I think from my own experience, and I think from the experience of folks at McKenna in general, if the GAO attorney becomes concerned that there's been some basic unfairness, whether that's in discussions, you had more discussions with the other guy than you did with me, or that kind of issue, or you didn't tell one offeror what its significant weaknesses and deficiencies were during discussions, but you did tell the other guy, that kind of thing, I think, is what tends to get GAO the most concerned. And then on those kind of issues, You know, the GAO is more likely to be less searching in terms of prejudice, because prejudice is an essential component of any successful protest. But when you're saying, hey, you know, if you told me that, here's what I would have done, GAO will be a little more lenient with you than on some of these other grounds.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it really is a prejudice. It's that what if, like, what, you know, and you don't know that. So, but, you know, in furtherance of competition and, you know, fairness in the system, giving people an opportunity to take a look at that,
yep.
and respond.
Yep.
That always struck me. But you know what? We've already gone through the first segment of the show, and we haven't heard from Jack yet.
Okay.
Jack, I mean, how'd you let your partner monopolize all this? I don't know what the heck's going on here. But when we come back, we'll be talking we'll talk a little bit more about BitProtest, but we'll start focusing on Civil False Claims Act and all those sort of bad things that can happen to you after you've won your BitProtest, or you got your contract, and or the protest was denied and you got to keep your contract. And that's with Jack Horan, partner at McKenna Long and Aldridge, and also Jason Workmaster is here, also partner McKenna Long and Aldridge, and you're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
This is an important time for the federal government, a chance for agencies to do things differently. How will you help shape your future? Turn to Deloitte. With our private sector insight and public sector experience, we'll help you rethink, reduce, and restructure, and turn resolve into results, so you can see what's possible and make it happen. See how at Deloitte.com/federal. Wherever you need to go, Deloitte sees you there.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guests are Jack Horan and Jason Workmaster. They are partners at McKenna Long and Aldridge. And Jack, I promise I'll let you get to say something here at some point. You can always kick him under the table too. But we got to finish a little bit on the bid protest, trends of last year, Jason. And one of the things that sort of struck me was that it looks like the number of hearings actually went down significantly from 2012 to 2013, like it looks like almost a, 40%, no more than 40%.
They almost dropped in half.
Yeah. So, and you know, from like 56 to about 31, I know that doesn't seem like a lot, but for the companies involved in those hearings, those are usually a big deal.
They are.
So, and do you have any sense of why or what's going on here?
It's difficult to know exactly why. And the other interesting thing I would just note is that from 2009, when you'd have a hearing is when you fully briefed all the issues, all the parties have submitted all their papers, and then there's a discussion about whether there's a need for a hearing. Well, in those kind of protests where all the papers are in 2009, GAO was having hearings in 12% of those protests, and now we're down to 3.4. So, I mean, if you compare us back just to 5 years ago, you know, we've dropped to a quarter of what it used to be. And I'm not sure exactly why that is. I know from my own practice, I think that GAO has been, that 100-day, they have a statutory deadline of 100 days. And to try and squeeze in a hearing after multiple rounds of briefing.
Yes.
You're working with like a 2 or 3 week window. And if you're going to squeeze in a hearing and then write a decision, that's very difficult to do. So I think that GAO has been sensitive to that. And unless a case is really crying out for a hearing, and also I think briefing, the way briefing has gone, at least protests I've been working on of late, the briefing lasts a lot longer than it used to. It's not just you file your initial protest, you get the agency report, you file your comments. It's the documents kind of trickle. Trickle in, a little more information comes in later. So you have all these rounds of briefing after what you would typically think you'd be done. So I think that's squeezing GAO. Also, because of the shutdown last year, that wouldn't be reflected in these statistics. So it'll be interesting to see what fiscal year 2014 statistics look like. But GAO was playing catch up for several months after the shutdown. So they were trying to push stuff out by a date just a few weeks ago in January. And I think that's also, for next year is going to impact this number as well.
Right, and I'm just looking to like at 2009, there were 65 hearings, and about 1,900, almost 2,000 protests.
Yep,
and then it's in 2013, you're talking 2,500 protests and 31 hearings. It almost you can almost see, you know, there's a direct correlation there. Yeah. It's like the number of protests has increased, the number of hearings have decreased, because maybe it's just a it's partly a workload issue.
I think it's probably
maybe they've raised a threshold to what it is takes to get a hearing.
Yep, I think that's likely the case.
Okay. This is Jack. Remember me, right?
Jack, glad you could join the show, Jack.
I'll jump in just for a second and, to say what I don't know. I'm not aware of any initiative by GAO to reduce the number of hearings, and there's nothing that I've seen in my bit protest practice that suggests that GAO is on that course. I guess one thing I've seen, Jason, arise more often over the years is outcome prediction, which I guess could lessen the number of hearings, and also the GAO attorney being very willing to tell the government what issues concerns the GAO attorney so that the government and the protesters can address those issues directly, which I guess could also lessen the need for a hearing.
Yeah, I think that's true too.
Yeah, and I mean, refresh my recollection if you can. Like the 40% number, is that in terms of outcome that's favorable to the protester? Is that sort of that's a consistent number pretty much? Or
I think that's been a fairly consistent number over time. I mean, if you just look at pure sustains in terms of going to a decision, I think that number is more closer to around 20 and has historically been around 20.
Okay.
But I think the 42-43% with the government taking some form of corrective action either on its own or a response to a sustain has been fairly static.
Okay. So now you've won the protest and then won the recompetition, or you've helped the government successfully defend against the protest, and you've got your contract, and then all of a sudden some bad things happen. And that's where Jack Horan comes in. And Jack, let's talk a little about 2013 and just the relator activity, Civil False Claims Act, and you know settlements and that kind of stuff. So just sort of big picture. Let's start with the big picture about what did 2013 bring us? Remember, it was 2013.
That's right. It was another very active year for False Claims Act recoveries for the government, Roger. The government reports that it recovered $3.8 billion with a B in False Claims Act recoveries, which is the second highest amount of recoveries in history, surpassed only by last year, and last year had a particularly large single recovery of about $3 billion. So we're talking significant amount of money that the government recovers. $2.9 billion of that $3.8 billion, which I think is roughly about 80%, were cases where the QI-TAM relator brought the case and not the government brought the case. And that's a progression that I've been seeing since the amendments to the False Claims Act occurred in 1986, a significant amount of cases increasing each year brought by relators for the first.
But relators bring the case, but then the government joins in?
Sometimes. About
20%
of the time the government joins in.
Only 20%, huh?
That's right. Okay. That's right. And whether the government intervenes, Roger, is very important, because in cases where the government doesn't intervene, that's 80%, as I said, of the QI-TAM cases, recovery is very limited. Only 3% of the total recovery was occurred under those cases where the government didn't intervene. And the other thing I've noticed is there's a trend. After the 1986 amendments, which made the False Claims Act very popular, the government brought...
Or unpopular, depending on your perspective, right?
The government brought the majority of False Claims Act cases for the first 7 years through 1994. Then there was a significant shift where QI-TAM relators brought the majority of False Claims Act cases. And now, out of the 846 cases filed in 2013, 752 or 90% were brought by relators rather than DOJ.
Really? So it's just that big an explosion in terms of people seeing it as an opportunity, or just the community or people just being more sensitized to what
I think
is out there? I mean, they see dollars. I mean, I'm just trying to understand what's driving these numbers?
A few things, I think. It took a few years for the bar, including counsel, the QI-TAM relators, to figure out the value of these cases, both to the relator and to the relator's counsel. And they become more, they've just become more popular. If you go on online and search whistleblower cases or QI-TAM relators or QI-TAM cases, you'll see a number of law firms out there that specialize in bringing these type of cases. In addition, I think plaintiffs, the QI-TAM relators themselves, have become more aware of the possibility for these cases through advertising, through DOJ's effort, through the QI-TAM bar's effort. And it can result in, as we all know, significant payment to QI-TAM relators.
So, you know, I think we're coming up against the break, Jack. So when we come back, we can talk about, you know, some key precedents that are out there from last year, some settlements and trials and that sort of stuff. But I also want to talk to you a little bit. Maybe you can give some thoughts about what people need, you know, how do companies, you know, sensitize themselves or deal with this, or, you know, how, what's this management or risk strategy for dealing with this kind of situations from a client's, from a compliance perspective. Excuse me if I can't talk right now and I'm on the radio, but that's what I was trying to say, compliance. It makes me nervous even talking about it. But right now we do have to take a break. But when we come back, we'll talk more to Jack Horan and Jason Workmaster. They are partners from McKenna, Long & Aldridge, and you are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
CACI delivers innovative information solutions and services to serve America's highest priorities, advancing efficiency and performance with business systems, countering the effects of complex threats with integrated security solutions, providing healthcare solutions for better, more affordable care, defending the nation against cyber threats, and helping veterans with its award-winning career-building program. CACI. Information deployed, solutions advanced. Missions accomplished. CACI, ever vigilant.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guests are Jack Horan and Jason Workmaster. They are partners at McKenna, Long & Aldridge. And we've talked a little bit about bid protests with Jason primarily, but with Jack as well. But also, when Jack has been focusing since we come back to the in the last segment, on, you know, some Civil False Claims Act issues, trends, and that sort of thing. And you went through some of the stats. And the thing that struck me, Jack, you said 887 million of like the 3.3 or 3.1 billion.
3.8 billion.
3.8 yeah. billion. Okay.
So roughly about a quarter.
Okay. A quarter of it are procurement. Okay. The rest of them are sort of like Medicaid and that kind
yes.
of. That,
yes. Yeah. A real significant area over the last few years have been in the healthcare industry, and particularly with pharmaceutical companies, there have been very large settlements that implicate the False Claims Act for off-label use of pharmaceuticals. So that's driven that number up significantly. But procurement-related cases have always been significant, and $887 million is nothing to sneeze at.
Right. But first, what is off-label activity? What does that mean?
It's when a pharmaceutical company's sales force promotes a drug for a use that it's not approved for.
Okay, yeah, and then I understand.
The tie to the False Claims Act case, so those drugs are often reimbursed through federal programs like Medicare or Medicaid, and sold through the VA. So that's the tie to the False Claims Act for those cases. And they've been there have been $1 billion settlements in those cases. In fact, I think the $3 billion settlement that I referred to last year, skewing the numbers, was a case of that type.
Yeah. Okay. So let's focus. Okay, I got that. So let's focus on the $887 million number. And we'd pay off the look. if we had that, but $887 million in government procurement related settlements, and you know, can you talk about some of the key trials or settlements and where things, you know, the highlights or lowlights, depending on your perspective?
Sure. I focused, I took a look at settlements in particular under the FSS program. And there have been, as there is every year, a number of significant settlements there that involve large sums of money. RPM International, which is a construction supplier, settled for $60.9 million under a GSA scheduled contract. Corning settled for $5.6 million. And then under the Mass Hardware schedule, one of the contractors settled for $70 million. And those, all three of those settlements related to pricing issues, either failure to disclose during pricing, commercial pricing during the negotiation process, or a failure to reduce prices under the price reduction clause, or probably, I don't recall, but probably both of those in all three of those cases. So significant settlements under the schedule program.
Yeah, and I have a question there about pricing. And like when DOG is looking at that, or the auditor is looking at it, so you know now that there's like statutory requirements for competition at the order level for any order over 150,000, and the contract price is X, but really the prices paid are, you know, in my view, driven by pricing at the task order level. You know, do they take that into consideration when they're figuring out what the potential exposure is, or is that sort of they just sort of try to use the highest price that's theoretically there, like the contract price?
I'm sure the Justice Department and the audit community are not taking into account the pricing at the order level. I'm sure that they have an approach. And my experience with the auditors is that their approach is, okay, now we have all this data of what you've sold, your lowest price you've sold to a commercial customer. We're going to take that, and we're going to take the price that you sold to the government, and we'll take the difference, and then we'll multiply that by three. So there's not a sense of, okay, since we had a competition at the ordering level, that somehow sanitized the price.
Yeah, right. I agree, Jason. It doesn't sanitize the price. It doesn't give you a free pass by saying you've established a fair and reasonable price by competition. But it works into the damages in that they're not comparing the GSA or VA list price, so to speak,
okay,
against
That's my,
the
yeah.
lowest commercial price. They're comparing the price actually sold to the government
yep.
against the
yep.
Commercial price.
That's so
right.
Theoretically, if it's a lower price that the government got based on that competition for a specific requirement, there's not a delta there to recover on?
That's right.
Okay.
I mean, in these cases, that's rarely the case for the majority of government sales, but if the ultimate government price because of the task order level is lower than the price the government says they would have negotiated at a full disclosure, then usually the contractor's okay. In my experience, DOJ hasn't come up with a theory as to why the government is damaged by your theoretical rather than your actual price. But Roger, I'm sure you've probably planted that seed in someone's mind right now. So we'll be facing that next time.
No. Well, my point was to, you know my view on this, that, you know, the price reduction clause is purely a tool to try to, you know, get money from contractors, quite frankly, at this point, and the way it's set up. I mean, given all the changes in the program from the statutory competition requirements to the dynamic market that's out there for commercial products and services and how people compete day to day, the price changes every day on lots of things.
Right. And I think, what the scenario that Jason was talking about, in my view, is not in a reasonable position. And that is if the contractor can demonstrate that the ultimate price to the government was a result of competition. The FAR says that's fair and reasonable, so you could take the position with DOJ that there shouldn't be any damages there.
Yep.
DOJ wouldn't accept that position, though, if there's a lower commercial price that they say they're entitled to.
And Roger, you're also, what you're suggesting also is not beyond the realm of possibility that an auditor or a Justice Department attorney would assert, well, if you had disclosed that price, we would negotiate an even lower schedule price, which means that the task order pricing would have been even lower than what you actually sold it for.
So yeah,
we'll
it's
theoretically possible, but I think that even the audit community, for the most part, realizes that getting a judge and jury to buy that one would be tough.
Right. So, in those situations, there's a lot of discussion of whether or not, you know, the most favorite, you know, the tracking customer, the deal is similar enough to the government's terms and conditions. Is that where the action is in terms of, let's say there is a delta, you know, and the government is paid a little higher price at the order level than some commercial customer? Is that where you have the debates in your experience about whether or not it's a similar deal that was to trigger it or what?
In my experience, you can have that debate about similarity to the government purchasing and various commercial customers when you're identifying the tracking customer
yeah.
or the basis of award customer. It's very difficult to try to have that debate with the Department of Justice or with the IG if there's a failure to disclose. I think it's a reasonable position to say these are different customers, so they shouldn't apply. But my experience, Jason, I'd like to hear yours, is that DOJ and IG and the IG aren't receptive to that argument.
And it's a very, the other thing is, I think just a matter of practicality, it's a very expensive argument to make. Because once you're in that position, because the auditors have the auditors have a very simple view. The auditors have spreadsheets that have prices on them, and they take the lowest price and compare it to what you sold to the government and take the difference, and there's what they think they owe. And then you, as the defendant in that instance, the contractor, you're the one coming in, well, but look at all this paperwork. And that means you've got to go find the paperwork, and you've got to pay people to review the paperwork. And so when you're looking
at the arguments.
The arguments, and that gets very expensive. And so when you look at, if you look at what happens in, 90% of these cases, that's a swag at the number. They settle. And the reason they settle is because the litigation gets too expensive. To litigate the case gets too expensive because you're paying lawyers and auditors yourself, or accountants.
And experts
and all that kind of stuff. And then you've got to take into account the litigation risks because, the auditors are going to, the government presentation is going to be, well, look at this simple delta, and you, the defendant.
Which is easier to
understand if you're a jury. And if you're the defendant, you're the one coming forward. Well, if you look at this piece of paper and that piece of paper and you put it all together and hold it up to the light just right, you'll see we win. Again, I think that's legitimate and appropriate, but it's expensive and risky.
Right. Yeah. There's power in simplicity.
There is.
Yeah. To me, I'd like to get your opinion on this. So that's why, how that tracking customer, what the terms and how it's written in the contract is vital. I mean, it's central to your compliance if you're a GSA schedule contractor, right? And that's often written by GSA and presented to the contractor.
That's right. For the FSS program, one of the most significant parts of compliance for avoiding False Claims Act cases is adequate disclosures at the time of negotiation and a fair and accurate identification of a tracking customer that leaves little to doubt as to what the parties intended.
Right. And that you can manage. Absolutely.
The best defense against the False Claims Act case comes when you're preparing your CSP up front before you have your contract.
Right. And on that note, we do have to take a break. But when we come back, we'll be talking more to Jack Horan and Jason Workmaster. They are partners at McKenna, Long & Aldridge. And you are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
The mission of government involves critical efforts to improve national defense, economic security, health services, and citizens' lives. The strategy and technology consultants of Booz Allen Hamilton are proud to help government address cyber threats, reform the financial system, modernize infrastructure, and protect our nation. For nearly 100 years, Booz Allen has partnered with clients to deliver results that endure. To see Booz Allen's ideas in action, visit BoozAllen.com.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guests are Jack Horan and Jason Workmaster. They are partners at McKenna, Long & Aldridge, and we've been talking bid protests. Now we've been, for the last segment and a half, we've been talking about Civil False Claims Act and trends in it, and I know we got a little sidetracked there and a deep dive into schedules, price reduction clause issues. I can't help myself sometimes, I guess. But Jack, are there other, key settlements or precedents that are coming out of 2013 that we want to hear about?
Yeah, there has been, Roger, in the typical areas under the 9B standard, which is a requirement for False Claims Act under the False Claims Act that relators plead fraud with particularity. There's also a common issue each year on what an applied certification is and what failures, compliance failures, can result in a False Claims Act case or support a False Claims Act case. But I've chosen two, one for the contractor and one against the contractor that I think are particularly significant. And one comes out of a case a contract that was performed in Afghanistan, I believe, certainly in a wartime area. And it was a False Claims Act case against the contractor, and there was a statute of limitations issue. And the government there alleged that the statute of limitation was suspended by an act called the Wartime Suspension of Limitations Act, which is found in the criminal code. And essentially that act says for cases of fraud against the government, the statute of limitation is told during times of war. And in this case, it was applied in a civil False Claims Act case. And the court accepted that argument and told the statute of limitation based on this, what most people viewed as a criminal statute found in the criminal code under the False Claims Act, Civil False Claims Act. And other cases since then have applied that to non-war situations. So based on that precedent, in my view, there's a significant argument that during the period the country was in a war status, that all False Claims Act cases charging fraud against the government have the statute of limitations told. Is that your view?
That is. And it's, you know, according to the court holdings here, we've been at war within the meaning of the statute since 9/11, and we're still at war. And it's unclear when the war is going to end because they held you don't have to have a congressional declaration. So you don't have to have a congressional declaration that a war has started. You don't need it's unclear. Well, we're certainly not going to get a congressional declaration that the war is over because they never declared that it had started.
Right.
So that's completely unclear. And if, you know, as Jack was saying, what this means is for the last, you know, if you did anything, if a contractor did anything within the last, 13 years that could be alleged to be a False Claims Act violation, they're still on the hook, because the statute has been told for the last 13 years.
So bringing it home to your FSS schedule contractors, that means to the extent they thought the statute of limitation may protect them from fraud allegations based on something they did in 2001, they are arguably incorrect about that because of this.
Again. Right. So your point too is that, right, it applies to any contract federal government during time of war.
Even if you were
war.
Selling pencils. To the Department of the Interior, it doesn't matter. But this case is the contractor is trying to get the Supreme Court to take the case, and the court actually has asked for the views of the Solicitor General, which is, on whether the case should be heard, which is actually at least some indication that the court has interest in hearing it. So
it seems to me if there's a government contracts case that they ought to be. Addressing this sounds
it's
like
this one.
There's a prime. I mean, this is like, because the war is never going to end. I mean, we're in a perpetual state of war with the war on terror.
Yes.
I mean, you could theoretically argue that it continues, and then 5 years from now, you just look at history. Whether it's the Libyans when President Reagan and the F-14s and they shut down the Libyan fighters and right. Well, I mean, just any kind of situation theoretically continues the war.
Preaching to the choir here, Roger.
Well, I'm just waiting for the Justice Department to assert that we've been at war since December 7th, 1941.
Okay.
Well, and the implication.
We also, wait a second. The Cold War.
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely.
So no, nothing is over, right?
Yeah, nothing is over.
Okay.
And outside the legal war world.
War. Hey, slip of the tongue there, Jack. I like that.
Outside the legal world, you sometimes think of the statute of limitations as a technicality, as a way for someone to get off on something. But there are, of course, legitimate reasons for the statute of limitations. So now you're perhaps forcing contractors to defend actions that happened more than 10 years ago. And if you think about even in your everyday life, to try to remember what you've done 10 years ago, let alone if you're a company, find the person who did something 10 years ago, right. Find the documents. It just puts ridiculous burden on contractors.
Well, it fundamentally boils down to risk and uncertainty, right? I mean, and that goes to price. So the government wants better pricing all the time. That's all you hear about these days, right? We got to drive pricing down, all this stuff.
I got you started again.
Yeah, well, it's true. It's like if you've got this uncertainty, business, you want certainty. That's when it makes investment. That's when it grows. That's when it, tries to figure out where's the next, opportunity to make money, to grow the business, that sort of thing. But when things are uncertain, companies pull back. And what you'll see eventually is companies leave the federal market.
Well, and that's a excellent discussion of the business uncertainty. If you add to that the litigation uncertainty and False Claims Act cases where, as Jason described earlier, the contractor feels like it's facing a stacked deck against them. And now you add this additional uncertainty as to how far back the government can go in its allegations of fraud. It's going to result, in my view, if the Supreme Court doesn't take some action or cases don't come out with the opposite precedent, of additional False Claims Act cases against contractors, because now there's no limit going backwards.
Right. Cold War. I go back to the Cold War. So you had another case you wanted to mention?
Here's the good news side for the contractor. There's a case coming out of the Seventh Circuit called U.S. v. Anchor Mortgage, which isn't a government contracts case, but where the court visited the damages that should apply in a False Claims Act case. And the Department of Justice, in my experience, and QI-TAM relators and some courts have accepted this, often take the position that the way you calculate damages under the False Claims Act cases is you take the amount of the claim, triple that under the False Claims Act, and then subtract the value that the government got under the contract. So that deduction occurs after the tripling, which is a significant disadvantage to contractors.
Oh, absolutely.
What the Seventh Circuit
said. One could say that's some fuzzy math.
What the Seventh Circuit said in U.S. v. Anchor Mortgage is no, you look at the value at the beginning of that calculation. So you take you discount the value received by the government from the alleged false claims, then you triple that difference, which is a much better situation for the contractor. In cases that I've handled often, where it would be very significant is Trade Agreements Act case, where the government is alleging that you failed to comply with the Trade Agreements Act, then the difference in calculation under the government's theory would be they got no value because it wasn't Trade Agreements Act compliant. You triple that, the full value of whatever's delivered, and then you subtract whatever a non-Trade Agreements Act item is worth. And here it's the opposite, the better solution under the U.S. anchor
it's
mortgage
really the
case.
You multiply the delta between the price paid and the and the value received, right?
That's what
That's right.
That
makes,
so it's
that makes sense to me anyway.
It's good to see that that view, the contractor's view, is catching on, and most recently in the Seventh Circuit that's appears to be accepted.
Well, I still wonder how do you calculate that back in the Cold War transaction. we have just about a minute left, and I we've been having some fun with this too. But I just if you guys want to give some final thoughts, there's a cost benefit sort of balance to all this stuff, and I just wonder if you have thoughts. Is it out of balance? What should be done? I mean, it seems to me that some of the situations that you've described, and the fact that damages calculation seems to make some more sense. There might, there's some good, some bad. Thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I'm probably going to have a critical view, but I think it's out of whack. The benefit of the false claims is out of whack to the cost to the contractor, and of course, I'm going to or likely have that perspective. But if you consider things like the compliance cost, particularly in areas where it's unknown, because you have the situation with implied certifications where a contractor is trying to figure out what the next area is going to be, where either the government or a QI-TAM relator is going to claim is a material noncompliance and then seek False Claims Act damages. The fact that the contractors often charged or required to pay multiple damages based on a non-intentional fraud under the False Claims Act case, I think finally, the fact that the relator, who oftentimes could be a participant as a contractor employee in some of the actions that they're later claiming are fraudulent, I think the cost to the contractor is higher than it should be, maybe not higher than the recovery to the government, but higher than it should be if the False Claims Act took a more reasonable view on some of the issues that
and somebody's paying those costs ultimately, right?
No, that's right. That's right.
It gets built into price. And what is that delta? Jason, final comment?
I agree with what Jack said. And also, to my view, it's just fundamentally unfair, because when you talk to contractors get hit with one of these cases, everyone's initial reaction, your gut reaction is, if I'm going to be on the hook for treble damages to the United States government, don't they have to show that I meant to deceive them?
Right.
I mean, if I just made a mistake, I just made a mistake, and if even that, I just made a mistake, don't they have to show more than that? And, you know, then you're left with this very squishy knowledge standard in the False Claims Act. And if you're going to be on the hook for that much money to the government, I don't think it's asking too much for the government to have to show that, you know, you actually meant to deceive them and simple mistakes. And, you know, it's frustrating. You know, I've had these conversations with Justice Department attorneys, you know, you forget, you don't put up the drug-free work zone poster.
Right.
Well, can they come after you for fraud for that? I mean, so you're not in compliance. It was a mistake. And they, you know, what I've heard from Justice Department attorneys is, well, that would have to be determined on a case-by-case basis. And I just think that's a fundamentally unfair system.
Right. Well, thank you guys. I want to thank my guests today, Jack Horan and Jason Workmaster. They are partners at McKenna Long & Aldridge. And you've been listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
You've been listening to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Off the Shelf, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.